everyone. It's September 22nd, 2019, and this is episode 197 of At Percussion. I'm Carly Vigna, and with me today are co-hosts Casey Cangelosi.
Hey, Carly. How are you doing?
Hey, Casey. I'm good. And Ben Charles.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Ben. I heard that you went to a really interesting concert lately. What was that about?
I did. On Friday night, just a couple of days ago, my former teacher and At Percussion podcast guest, Ed Smith, did a concert with his world percussion group called D-Drum at the Meyerson Performing Arts Center, which is where the Dallas Symphony performs. So it's pretty rare to get to see a percussion ensemble perform on such a, you know, prestigious stage like that. The concert ran probably about 2.5 hours, and they're kind of a world percussion focus group. It was cool. They opened up with some sort of traditional gamelan music, and each member of the group ended up doing a solo at some point. Ron Snyder, who's the leader of the group, just blew my mind with a cymbalome solo. They closed the first half with a sort of world music version of the Beatles' Within You, Without You. The second half had just an amazing shakuhachi player, which is a Japanese bamboo flute. I have never heard anything, even at all my PASICs, like, I've never heard anything like this concert. It was just awe-inspiring, and you could just see so much joy on all the musicians' faces as they performed. It was a wonderful concert. Oh, also, one other thing, Doug Howard, who's the retired principal percussionist of Dallas Symphony that plays in the group, he played like a rope drum. He played Three Camps and Downfall of Paris. I can't say that I've ever actually seen the old school rudimental style performed on a rope drum. So very, very cool stuff. Definitely check out D-Drum if you have the chance. And we need to get Ron Snyder on the podcast because I'd love to hear about the group's history.
I saw them at a PASIC when I was a kid, and I still remember it so well. Really, really blown away.
Sounds like a whole lot of everything that we don't get to see very often.
Yes,
live, and in person.
A whole lot of gear schlepping as well, I'm sure.
Right. I'm thinking like a set of gamelan, like for one concert, like that's enough gear.
That alone, yeah.
Cool. Thanks for sharing that with us, Ben. Our guest today is Dr. Stuart Gerber. Stuart is an international performer and advocate for new music. He has collaborated with many, many notable composers, including Karlheinz Stockhausen, Steve Reich, Vinko Globokar, Frederick Jevsky, George Crumb, Michael Colgrass, and so many more. Stuart is the co-artistic director of the Atlanta-based new music group Bent Frequency and also serves as the professor of percussion at Georgia State University. Welcome to the show, Stuart. It's so great to have you on.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Stuart, I have a question just to get us fired off right off the bat here. I'm shamefully not super familiar with your work, but when I look at your online presence, it seems like you do a lot of the sort of avant-garde European school, we'll call it the Steve Schick sort of repertoire, the Stockhausen and so on. Mm-hmm. And I have dabbled in a little bit of this sort of music, but haven't gone head over heels in the way that you have. And one thing that, especially at the beginning of the semester here with my students, I always wonder, how do you practice this music that's so different? It's not just music that you would stick a metronome on.
Actually a lot of it is,
I should say it's not music that you would exclusively just stick a metronome on slowly and work your tempo up is what I mean by that. Yeah,
sure. And, you know, I, especially, the piece Zicklus of Stockhausen, that's always, that's one that comes up a lot. It's graphically notated, and it's sometimes it takes a minute or more to kind of figure out the notation. But as you get into it more, it actually becomes pretty clear that you do have to stick a metronome on it, and you just have to kind of still practice slowly and consistently, and, you know, you just work it up like anything else at some level. Now, you know, with that piece in particular and others as well, you know, there's a lot of time that you have to spend kind of away from the instruments too, and just think and work on just conceptual ideas about what you want to get across or what the composer's trying to get across, which maybe you don't have to do with some of our repertoire as much, but you know, a good musician will do that on any level with any piece, you know, take it away. Think about it, not just while you're at the vibraphone or at the setup or whatever, and you know, think, okay, well, what's the point of this, rather than just playing the licks, you know, although we have to do that as well.
You said conceptual, and I feel like I use this word all the time, and I have a very set idea what it means, and I think we all might as well, but can you tell us what you mean by that, maybe especially for some of our listeners who don't categorize music into one genre and then another genre called conceptual and another called heavy metal, whatever. What's conceptual?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. What do I mean by that? I think... when there's a piece, I mean, I'll keep using Ziklus because I think that's a piece that even if you've never played it or even heard it, a lot of us are familiar with the score. At least I would hope we are from, you know, history books and you know, lessons and things like this. But, you know, if you have a piece that isn't maybe straightforward in terms of, okay, the rhythms and the notes, this piece happens to be graphic, you have to think about, okay, what is the point of the graphic notation? What is the point in this case of, you know, do the graphics line up with the sound, or is it something more abstract from that? And just thinking about what the point of, in this case, the notation is, or in any case, what the point of the pieces of what someone is, you know, if it's not your own, thinking about, well, what is the point that you need to get across, or what kind of ideas, musical ideas, are you willing or wanting to get across?
Yeah, well, and then there are so many other concepts like choreography. How are you going to move around your setup that you have to consider? And then one other thing is when there's indeterminate sounds or indeterminate form of the piece to do away from the setup, I think is really good. You know, and I know we're going to talk about this piece, but I think I'll jump into it now, the piece Himmelstür. Stuart, yeah. Maybe if you want to talk about the challenge of practicing that piece specifically.
That's a challenge, because there's, you know, the 7 foot high Heaven's Door is not a standard percussion instrument found in most studios, so it's not something that you can just go in and practice on. I was very lucky to be a part of this piece, and to be able to premiere it and work with him with Stockhausen on it. He sent me the score to this in I think November or something of 2005. And I opened the score, you know, it wasn't a PDF. He actually sent it in the mail in this large format, and it's graphic, it's graphically notated. And he said, okay, this piece is Heaven's Door. And he wrote a little letter with it and said, we need to find an old church door that we will build a frame for and play the piece. And so I said, oh, great. Okay. I wasn't sure how I was going to do that or how it was going to get done.
Oldchurchdoors.com. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, funny you should say that, because, you know, like with many things in Germany, there is a company or a firm that has these old church doors or tries to resell them for, I don't know what for, maybe for architectural reuse or something. He sent, I wasn't, you know, I was in the States. So he sent a couple people to this place to hit the doors and see how they sounded. And of course they sounded horrible because they weren't made for music. And I would assume that if it was an old church door, it means maybe it was rotting away or something, they had to replace it. So at that point he decided, you know, the score was done. And so he decided that he had to build a door or have a door built for the performance. And so he did so. And the performance was the following June. So in the meantime, I had to figure out I had to practice the piece, and I had no idea what the instrument was going to sound like. And so he described what he wanted. You know, it's a double door with six panels on each leaf. So, you know, 12 pitches arranged high to low, not tuned to specific pitches, but just high to low. And so I have a double door in the percussion studio here, and one of the rooms has a double door. There are never enough double doors in percussion studios. I think we can probably all agree with that.
Of course.
But we had one, but it had, you know, windows on it, and it had these lever door handles or whatever. So it wasn't ideal, but I took masking tape and I taped off the rough sizes of the panels and, you know, tried to play this thing. And it was actually, even the heavens door is taller, so I even had to go under the drywall a little bit above the door. But it, you know, was totally unsatisfying because it was this laminate material and sounded horrible, and there was no pitch differentiation, you know, and it wasn't something that I really enjoyed practicing because I didn't have a concept of the sound of what was going to happen. So this was I'm sorry for this long answer, but I think it'll make sense. So then it goes to I didn't get to play on the door until April. So that was November to April while I was trying to learn this thing. And then finally, when I got on the instrument, I realized, okay, now I know how this thing sounds. So obviously to mount that piece, you need to come up with an idea of, you have to have a door built or find someone. There's a few doors now in existence, so maybe you rent it or something. But it's a problem. I mean, percussion is always logistically tricky, especially if you're traveling or something. But especially with this piece, I mean, it's a whole nother level of logistic trickiness.
I loved seeing you play this at PASIC. I actually have a funny story/confession. I saw it, I loved it, and, you know, went away from it. I'll never forget it. In fact, I posted on Facebook just for, you know, call for questions. I said, did anybody see this madman, Stuart Gerber, play this piece at PASIC? I'll never forget it, and I mean in the good way. And anyway, so it was just, but anyway, the funny part of the story is, in my mind, it was months later, after thinking back on this, it was Gene Kaczynski that performed it. And for years, that's what I thought. And I bumped into Gene, and I said, Gene, man, your performance, this might have been my first time meeting Gene Kaczynski. I was like, dude, your Heaven's Door, that Stockhausen, was amazing. He was like, that wasn't me. That was Stuart Gerber, dude. I said, wow, well, for years, I've been telling people you played this piece at PASIC that was just amazing, amazing, amazing.
Casey, I just looked it up, by the way. Gene, you might be confused because I just looked it up. I didn't remember this, but Gene Kaczynski did play the same concert, looks like songs 1 through 9 by Stuart Sondheim.
Oh, good. Yeah. So there we go. That's
not totally
he was on the concert. And Garrett Mendola was on the concert too, and Morris Palter. And he was there. So at least that was correct.
Well, that's funny that Gene didn't. It's funny Gene didn't tell me that. You know, he didn't say like, oh, I played on that concert, so you're not too much a fool. He just told me I was a fool.
Let really. You bask in it. I missed this. What year was this PASIC performance?
I think 2013, although maybe. Okay. I think that was right.
That sounds about right. Well, but you mentioned this conceptual idea, and I think you've explained the, you know, how you practice that piece, and that makes, of course, perfect sense. Can you explain kind of your concept and maybe what Stockhausen told you of what this piece is supposed to mean and represent? I think to those of us who saw it, it's pretty obvious. But then again, something I love about those concerts at PASIC is it's not too hard to find someone a few feet away who's just says like, what the hell was that at the end, you know? And I love that. Like, what do you say to the person who's like, what the hell is that supposed to be, you know?
So, you know, I'm sure there are some listeners who maybe have not seen or heard the piece, but I'll give it away or whatever. So, you know, after 20 some minutes of playing the door, I mean, so the door, it starts off innocently enough. I mean, the performer walks up and plays some individual notes, kind of an exploratory manner. And then the next page, it's a little bit more active, and the piece kind of builds, you know, and every page has kind of a different character. There's one page that he prescribes. He says, you know, angry, kind of pleading. There's one that's humorous. I turn my front to the audience. I turn around and I kick the door and do this, you know, it's supposed to be kind of funny. But basically the arc of the piece is, you know, you're getting more intense. And the idea is, he didn't tell me exactly what his idea was. And I kind of regret not asking him, although I think I have a sense of it. But he did tell me that he got throughout his career, he's said that he's received a lot of inspiration for his music through his dreaming, through dreams. Like the percussion piece music in Bauch, he had a dream about this bird man that in Music in the Belly that is part of the piece. But he had this dream of, you know, performer, person going, getting to heaven, and, you know, there being a wooden door there, and a door that you have to kind of, as a musician, play into, you know, get yourself into through playing and maybe explaining your life through this or whatever. So the piece progresses and it gets more intense, and at some point you're running around and you fall on the floor, and it, by the end you're playing all over the thing. And then finally it opens and the performer walks through, and then directly behind the stage, or behind the open door, but behind a screen, are a couple of tam-tams, four cymbals, and two pairs of hi-hats, and the performer starts playing those quite loudly. The audience doesn't see it, so all of a sudden they hear this cacophony of loud metals. And after about 2 minutes of that, air raid siren starts going off, a recording of an air raid siren. And about 2 or 3 minutes after that, a little girl, about 8 to 10 years old, something like that, gets up from the audience and walks through the audience onto the stage and through the door without any issue, and the piece ends. And so then, to answer your question of someone would say, what the hell was that? Someone asked Stockhausen at the Stockhausen courses in, I think it was 2007 or something. They asked him about, you know, what he meant by that ending. And he said, well, I wanted to show that heaven is not just ice cream. And that was his that was his answer.
That clears it up.
I know, right?
That's great.
So for me, I always say, of course, I'm of this generation, but I don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie from the 90s, Dogma.
Oh, yeah.
With Alanis Morissette as God.
Yeah.
So at the end, she comes down and, you know, the angel, I forget exactly what happens, but the angels kind of tell the humans they have to cover their ears, because if God speaks, it's so incomprehensible to them that they will, I guess, perish or, you know, die, I guess. And so they couldn't not hear the voice of God, basically. And so I kind of think of it that in those terms, like, not that Stockhausen was watching Alanis Morissette as in that movie, but this idea that this cacophony, this sound that we can't comprehend, or we, as in our human form, have no concept of, and it just sounds like cacophony. And then, you know, and then obviously this innocent little girl can enter, and I as maybe the sinner, or as the adult, have to prove myself, kind of a thing.
It was so beautiful. Like, you had to work so hard to get it open, you know. Yeah, and it was very clear you were working so hard. You know, I just loved the piece. Yeah,
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a unique and special piece for sure. I'm lucky to have that in my repertoire for sure.
Well, this piece to me kind of embodies so much of what I like about theatrical percussion, or works that involve the theatrical elements, like just the physicality of the piece from how it sounds. Everything you have to do to then make the door open, it just adds so much. It's not just about the sound that you're creating. Of course, the sound is important.
Yeah.
You know, it's a percussion solo, but all the movement that you're making, and then the dramatic element of having this other character, this little girl, just walk through. It's just so cool. Casey, to piggyback on your question of what the hell was that? Stuart was actually just at FIU a couple of weeks ago. He was in town for a performance, and he came and talked about Stockhausen with my whole studio and some of my students who had never heard of Stockhausen and had never experienced so many of the things that they're seeing and hearing about. And I was anticipating some questions like, what the hell was that? And it inspired some really great discussion in our next studio class. A couple days later, I said, I want you all to think about what is music, and what, you know, what is valuable in contemporary music and in solo percussion repertoire. And then we talked about it. It was great. And I'm so happy to say none of them said, what the hell is that? They were all so open and receptive. And Stuart, you did a great job of making it so relatable and accessible. And I think, you know, that was just really evident. But after this discussion in our studio class, I was reflecting on what we talked about, and I thought of a few quotes by John Cage that I remember kind of helping me digest new contemporary concepts, especially when I was getting into theatrical percussion works when I was in school. So I wanted to share these with you. They're from Silence, which is a collection of lectures and writings by John Cage. And the first lecture in the book is called The Future of Music, Credo. And this text was delivered as a talk at a meeting of a Seattle Art Society that was organized by Bonnie Bird in 1937. It was printed in the brochure accompanying George Avakian's recording of Cage's 25-year retrospective concert at Town Hall in New York in 1958. Here's the first quote. It's right at the beginning of the lecture. Wherever we are, what we hear is mostly noise. When we ignore it, it disturbs us. When we listen to it, we find it fascinating. The sound of a truck at 50 miles per hour, static between the stations, rain. We want to capture and control these sounds, to use them not as sound effects, but as musical instruments. And then I skip ahead just a little bit. The next passage I want to share with you is, if this word music is sacred and reserved for 18th and 19th century instruments, we can substitute a more meaningful term, organization of sound. And I thought this was so cool after the discussion I had with my students, because when I asked them what is music, so many of them had some version of organized sound or organized sound in silence. And I think that's probably totally different than what would have been said if, you know, when John Cage first gave this lecture in 1937, or even when it was revisited in 1958, totally different than the answer that people might have given then about, you know, melody and harmony and rhythm, and it has all these elements. Anyone have any comments on that?
I think it might also be a different response if this were, you know, a violin studio or a piano studio. Mm-hmm. Or something. I mean, I think something at the heart of what we do embraces that. But I will also say that I think, you know, those were pretty cutting edge ideas at the time, and they're still not the mainstream probably for the average person on the street. But it does show that there are that your students, kind of connected to that. And they didn't hear the quote, correct? This was.
No.
Right. So it's kind of inherent, maybe because of the percussionist, but also I think, you know, in the last, 20, 30, 40 years, there's also been composers, performers who really focus on this kind of environmental performance, soundscape kind of things, you know, using the natural world in conjunction with, you know, typical music sounds, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something that's been growing too and is really exciting, and percussion's always incorporated that at some level too. So I think there's a lot, it's interesting to see where we're going. Just maybe sound is becoming, you know, is taking more of a front seat. It'll probably never be the same as sight in terms of our senses, but I think it's interesting that we're more cognizant of that now, perhaps, maybe not.
Well, and then in pieces where sound and sight are combined with, you know, dramatic elements too, it's just, I think, really effective and really reaches people.
Yeah.
So it's just, I have so many thoughts about all this right now. it's funny. The sort of music is organized sounds and silences is the definition I use in like my music appreciation class. And I think that pretty fairly and captures all of it. And I think that Stuart brought up a good point that 100 years ago, people probably would have been saying something about melody and harmony and these things. And quite frankly, we're probably the rule breakers that forced it out of that mold, thanks to John Cage and percussionists. Mm-hmm. But it also reminds me of, like, I used to have this delineation when I was, like, 18 years old in my head as something different between what I would call music and what I would call sound art. And so, to me, sound art was maybe something like Zeichlus, and music was something like a Bach chorale. And, like, the more and more I thought about it and studied music, the more and more those two kind of converged. And then, like, at a certain point, I realized that making that distinction wasn't really possible or even worthwhile. Like, how does something cross that line into not being music anymore but still being sound art? And it also, like, this whole discussion reminds me of something Morris Pulitzer said. And he was talking about, I think the definition of music sort of question. And yeah, I think organized sound and silence sort of encompasses that. That doesn't mean that you have to like it, like anything, as a listener or a performer. And Morris said, like, you know, like, yeah, you can make green onion ice cream. Like, I'm not going to tell you that's not green, that's not ice cream, but it's still, you know, it's not something that I'm interested in. But maybe it's out there for someone. And yeah, and a lot of this, like, I'm a big Mark Applebaum fan who was on the podcast also, and he talks about the composer as almost like an experimental scientist, where you don't do an experiment to see that it works, you do it to see what happens. So yeah, there was no clear train of thought to any of what I just said, but just a lot of little mini ideas.
Well, speaking of music, Aprish, the first thing coming up in the course packet is music definition. And so, fun thing, and I think I've told this story on the show at some point, but ask your students to, you know, pull out their cell phones and look up a definition of music, and they come up with all these different ones, and none of them is very all-encompassing and satisfying, because it's so easy to find a counterexample to any one of them, including John Cage's organized sound. It's like, well, then is speaking music? It's like, no, that's right, but that's totally organized sound, but it's not music. Shoot, like, there's, you know, that's the fun of it. And then eventually, yeah, I guess the place you grow into is sort of Mark Applebaum-esque type of opinions, like, is it music? Well, whatever. Is it interesting? Is it cool? What, you know, eventually, yeah, stop caring about that. Oh, I see Ben. Me. Okay, go.
I also, in my music appreciation class, the first thing I do is like that, like, what is music? And then I talk for a bit. And then I got this quote. Carly and I had a teacher at Miami named Tom Sleeper, and he told us this quote, and I looked it up. It's by a music critic named Martin Mull. And he says, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. It's a really stupid thing to want to do. And it's like, yeah, like, at the end of the day, like, we can sit here and talk about it all day long, but, like, isn't it more interesting just to, like, taste it, so to speak? Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I've always come up with this, like, organized sounds and silence, but then I also say, like, you know, if we could really put into words what it was, it wouldn't be worth having.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask Stuart about Stockhausen's personality. You know, I think I've watched a lot of, his lectures on YouTube, and I've watched about everything that is easily reachable and accessible. And I've heard so many different things about him as a person. It's, you know, you can find these lectures that are make him seem really off-putting, and we've got these crazy quotes about 9/11 being the greatest work of art ever conceived, and, you know, just. From your viewpoint, what was Mr. Stockhausen like?
He was really wonderful and giving, very hard on the musicians, like really trying to push you to be your best and to, you know, and to realize his music as precisely as he heard it. But when you put in the work and show him that you are serious about it, he was nothing but friendly and supportive and all those kinds of things. And I worked with him at the end the last few years of his life. And I think he also kind of mellowed out too, because I've heard stories, you know, of him very, very tough on musicians, in the performers in the, you know, 60s and 70s and things too. I mean, he was a very, he had an artistic vision. He knew what he wanted, and he tried to push people to get that and maybe push them too far sometimes. The 9/11 quote, that's an interesting time, obviously, as, you know, not even as it obviously doesn't relate to Stockhausen, but, you know, the whole press conference that was, if you read the whole transcript of the press conference, he does preface that quote by saying, well, I should also say You know, for 25 years, he worked on this opera cycle called Light. And there are seven operas in this cycle, one for every day of the week. So there's Monday from Light, Tuesday from Light. And he worked on this from 1978 until 2003. So when the September 11 attacks happened, he was very much within this world of Light. And Light has three main characters. Michael, who represents man. Eve, who represents the earth, kind of Mother Earth, and then Lucifer, who represents chaos and destruction. And this is a mythology that he kind of created for the opera. It's also related to the Urantia book, which is a whole discussion in and of itself. But he's prefaced that quote, that infamous quote about the greatest work of all time by saying, I don't have a verbatim, but to the reporters and things, he said something, okay, now you're going to have to kind of switch your mind or something. He said something like that, meaning kind of bear with me or think of it from a different perspective. And he said, you know, it's like the greatest work of art based that Lucifer would do. So this idea of the coordination and, you know, creating this immense amount of chaos and destruction. So, of course, it was ill-advised for him to say anything really regarding that, but
that is kind of a shame that you could say something. I mean, that changes it entirely. Like, yeah. That's and the greatest work of art the freaking devil could ever do. I mean, that completely changes it entirely.
And you don't often hear that component. It's like,
no,
you know, it's like fake news or whatever, right? This idea.
Out of context.
You know, yeah, exactly. And so you can find a full. I've read the full transcript many years ago, but you can find it and you can look into it. But it was the next day or next couple of days, and he's, you know, ill-advised to kind of even, but someone asked him about it. You know, of course he had this big press conference because he was the guest at I think the Berlin Festspiele or Hamburg. It was in Hamburg. It was a big festival. It was like 7 days of his music or something, and they canceled everything because of that. So, you know, it was a controversial thing to say for sure, but you know, he no way meant to, you know, upset anyone, or, you know, he just, that was his, you know, he's lived in that world of his own kind of mythology with the opera for 25 years. And, you know, he lived a very isolated life in many ways. He didn't watch TV. He didn't, he had internet and email and things, but like he worked and it was his music and that's what he lived for. And so, you know, I don't know. So that's a little bit more of the story of that. But he was always nothing but wonderful for me, you know, pushing me. And I learned a lot from him as a performer, and I'm very grateful to him. And, he also, you know, when I was there rehearsing, many times I would eat dinner at his house, and, you know, so he was very welcoming at the same time. So interesting personality.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. And he was, you know, one thing people would say too, especially maybe back in the olden days, but this is true. I mean, he was a tall guy and just a very commanding presence. And so he's, you know, one of these guys that just walks, one of these people that just walks into the room and everyone, you know, the attention just goes there. Now, by the time I come along, it's shock. I was walking into a room, so everyone knows. But I think he always had that kind of presence even before he was, you know, Stockhausen. So just some people just have that kind of energy and that kind of draw in a way.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, one more question related to Stockhausen. How do you help audiences connect with his music or even with other contemporary music that you're presenting?
That's a good question because... I think maybe it was Ben who said earlier, yeah, a lot of the repertoire I do is kind of steeped in that European tradition, you know, avant-garde tradition, though I play plenty of, you know, I'm kind of a Stockhausen guy, but I play plenty of other music. But a lot of the things we do with my group, Bent Frequency and other things, you know, it's quote unquote avant-garde music, or we always are trying to present new ideas and new things, you know, related to what is music. And, so, but what we find, I think discussions are a really wonderful way to do it. You know, I think, Carly, I was able to speak with your studio about Stockhausen specifically, and I have a like an hour and a half long kind of presentation, kind of a lecture recital that I've done over 50 times at university whenever I'm traveling. I can do kind of a traditional masterclass and have done them, but I also feel like this experience I've had with Stockhausen is maybe more unique. And so I kind of use those opportunities. I often reach out to the percussion profs and say, I'm happy to do a masterclass, or I have this other thing. And it's usually pretty well received. And so I just explain, in that case, those five solo pieces. People don't realize that there are five solo pieces that he wrote. And then I talk about the aesthetic of them, of his music, and of why I'm drawn to them. And then I play a couple. I play some clips on you know, video clips and things too. I think that's, you know, I hate to say it. I mean, I would love it for music to stand on its own. And in a lot of circles, you can do that. Like if you, you know, like at PASIC, when we have, you know, audiences of really well-informed musicians, and maybe we can just play and let that be the thing. But when we're kind of in the real world, and you know, even the more tame stuff we do, I'm using a lot of air quotes, I apologize. You know,
I'm going to edit all of them out.
Yeah, that's fine. even some more of the more traditional things we do, you know, still is for the average listener might not be something that they're expecting, or, you know, and so I find it really great to be able to, you know, a good idea to talk about the pieces a little bit. Sure, there's program notes, but we try to, I think a lot of times in concerts, just give a little spiel before the piece. Obviously, you don't want to talk too much, but that's usually, I think, the best way. Or we'll sometimes do talk back sessions after performances, you know, so to not interrupt the flow of the concert. But I think that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, even pre-concert talks, yeah, when you go to a really traditional orchestral, you know, symphony, yeah, concert, like that helps people.
Yep.
Just be more interested and understand. It's not just the, you know, this tradition that they don't know anything about. It just makes it accessible.
I like talking. I don't like the quote Ben gave from the whoever hoity-toity guy that said, "Don't talk about music." I think you should. I think that's.
I didn't see that.
And you know, well, you
think it's different context for that. But if I could also add,
oh no, he's hoity-toity.
If I could also add, though, like just to state the obvious, like playing it well. And yeah, like not being self-conscious about playing something like weird, like a piece I've mentioned before, Mark Applebaum's Aphasia. I learned it kind of sitting in my bedroom as a hobby. I didn't think I'd ever perform it. And then I started playing in front of people and people were just like in love with it. Yeah. Okay, well, I guess people dig this.
Well, that's the ultimate. That's an example of an ultimate kind of visual piece. But all the things we do are so visual, which I think helps us usually. Mm-hmm. You know, especially multi-piece, well, anything, even solo mallet pieces and things that might be kind of out there. I mean, I think that the choreography now, but, you know, as I'm saying this, I'm also thinking, you know, you can know, you know, there are folks who kind of go over the top with it too, and it shouldn't be an affectation. But obviously, I think, you know, that kind of visual element helps a lot of times, you know. But I think you're right, Ben, really playing the heck out of something is really probably the most important thing.
Yeah, well, I think the physicality of what we do, of course, no matter what, like if we're moving in a way that expresses and lines up with what we want to express musically, with the notes and phrasing and everything, whatever we're playing, then yeah, of course. I mean, but most instruments are like that. I think, you know, if you watch a great string player play the movement that they use, you know, to varying degrees, but yeah, yeah, everything that we do.
Yeah,
you can always see. I think you can see exactly how the sound is made in percussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and a violin, like you can get it, but you, I mean, the effect can be so much grander than the nuanced difference in violin. Whereas the grand effect, you're going to really see the difference in percussion. This is why, you know, little kids are just always watching the percussionists, and why they all want to be drummers in middle school. It's just like, you understand so much, you know.
And it's so easy. You know, you can just touch it, yeah, and it sounds, and you don't have to have an embouchure. You don't have to have, you know, just.
Right. Right. Ben, did you have something, or did it pass already?
Oh, I had a non-Stockhausen question, actually. So it seems like you worked with percussion and piano a lot. And one of the standard questions I always ask when we have a guest like you on is like, tell us about your experience with the Bartok. It's such a wonderful piece and a core of our repertoire. And I might have only performed it 2 or 3 times all in one like semester. But it's an amazing piece. And I'd love to hear from someone that's played it more than me.
I'm glad it's not a non-Stockhausen question, but I'm going to relate Stockhausen to it. A little known fact, he did his master's thesis on that piece. Like he wrote an analysis of the Bartok Sonata. Oh, wow.
If I could add like a weird thing to this, there is a professor at University of Miami named Frank Cooper, who is one of the best musicology professors I've ever had. But Carly played the Bartok with me on my DMA recital, and I invited Frank Cooper to the recital because he's a piano repertoire guy. And he emailed me and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I would love to be there. Unfortunately, I have an engagement that night, but it would mean a lot to me because my teacher was also Bartok's teacher."
Wow.
Like, whoa. Yes, I was like, God, yeah. So the engagement he had was actually a retirement party because obviously he was on the older side of things. Yeah. I mean, just super cool.
Yeah. I mean, that piece, I mean, it's classic. I think it's really fun to play. I played it a few times. I played the orchestral version too, the kind of concerto version. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. I've never gotten to play it, but yeah, I know. Yeah. There's a concerto version that exists.
It's
yeah.
a quirky piece. I don't know the history. I should probably know history about it, but it seems like the orchestral part is really kind of an afterthought in a lot of ways.
It was written second. I can't remember all the history. Sure. But basically, he wrote the quartet, and then I think the last piece he ever played was actually, I don't know if it was the concerto or the regular version, but yeah.
The last one he played.
Last one he performed is like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's a monster to put together. Although, you know, I played both parts. I played the timpani part more, and it's a blast. But I, you know, it all rests on the pianist for that piece. I mean, it's such a monster. And if you don't have really solid pianist, there's not much you can do. I mean, it's great writing and it's fun, but it's at the end of the day, it's for me, it's really very orchestral, even though it's a chamber piece, but which is great. But you know, if the orchestra of the pianos isn't really just finely tuned, it's a schlock. But you know, when you have those pianos who are really willing to do it, and then it's just, you know, it almost plays itself in a lot of ways, even though the tuning's crazy and everything. It really
for us,
for sure. But I mean, if everything's rocking and you have pianists with really good time and everything, then it's a joy. I haven't played it for a few years, but maybe you have to bring that back out again.
So, but it's two quick questions, I guess, since you played both parts. One, in the third movement, how do you handle the cymbal transition? And two, what do you do to flip the snares on and off?
Okay, the cymbal transition.
The timpani part where you play the crash in the really fast move.
I just have two. I use small 16-inch, and I kept the timpani mouth, and I picked up the cymbals and I played it.
So you just did it.
Yeah,
my hat trick
with the timpani mouths in your hand still.
As I was holding the straps, kind of goofy. Yeah.
Wow,
that's great.
Yeah.
And you that's like what you I came up with. You just put the cymbals down yourself. No one grabbed them or anything.
No,
man.
I think maybe early on. Yeah, maybe I did something. Can the other percussionists grab it? Is that something that's thing? Maybe that happened early on. But I know the last time I did, I remember just having them very close and, you know, I had my timpani, I didn't drop the sticks. It was odd, but
good for you.
I think it's not, who knows? I don't know if there's a recording. And then what was the other one?
Did you have any sort of rigging for the turning the snares on and off, or did you just flip it on and off regular?
Yeah, flipped it on and off regular. Though no one time, so again related to Stockhausen, I made a snare stand. What's Casey looks annoyed. I have a modified hi-hat stand that I made to dampen snares, and then I push the pedal down and the snares sound. So I used that once, but it's a pain to travel with. So the last time I did it, I didn't use that. I must have just turned them on. And probably not very elegantly.
Ben might break off to do his own podcast series called the Bartok Sonata Symbols. Called,
how did you play the Bartok?
Right. How did you deal with the symbols?
Casey,
are you a no-high?
We were talking about what to do with episode 200, just Bartok supercut of every time I've asked about this piece.
That'd be pretty cool. It would be nice to have them all together, see everyone's answers back to back. That would be fun.
Oh, we got to get John Haas back on to ask about that.
Oh, man.
Did you ask him
those questions?
No, we got to talking bad about Mersh and yeah.
Wow.
Hey, before we go totally off the rails, Casey, I think you have what happened today in music.
Yeah, sure. So we're releasing on October 3rd, and some cool, just fun trivia items. I didn't dig deep into any of them, but they're just fun to know as they are. So two of our very famous composers entered into university. One of them was in 1894 on October 3rd. Charles Ives started at Yale University, and later in 1904 on October 3rd, Edgar Varèse entered his studies at the Scala Cantorum in Paris. And also, this one's for Ben. In 1988, the John Lennon documentary Imagine premiered in Hollywood, California. I assume you've seen that, Ben?
No, I've actually never even heard of it.
Oh, really? And Imagine. Okay. Yeah. I know. I think I've seen bits and pieces. I don't think I've seen the whole thing, but I'm not the Beatles fan that you said you were.
So we talk about Charlie Ives in my music appreciation class. Does everyone know what Charles Ives did for a living?
Yeah. Sold insurance.
Yeah. Life insurance. Yeah.
Yes.
Made a fair amount of money out of it, I think.
Yeah, and from what I think it was like Farmers Mutual Life Insurance is like the descendant of whatever he was doing, I think. But I've heard that he was so good at it that they still use his practices today.
That's right. Yeah, and I was going to say someone told us that, and it must have been you, Ben, because that, it wasn't just like, oh, I've got to sell insurance so I can pursue my true love type of thing. Like, no, he was really, really good at it. And yeah, like you said, they still use, I guess, his book today, his method.
And he was into the idea of like if you're an artist for a living, you're going to have to sacrifice your artistic ideals at some point to pull a profit. And so he said, no, I'm going to just be very wealthy independently and write the music I want to write.
Right. You can't. Yeah. You can't be a good artist if you also have to do it for a living. Yeah. So he thinks we're all terrible.
Phonies.
Yeah,
and Bach was pretty terrible too. All that church music.
Bach had the organ repair gig going for him, so he could support himself.
So he applies. A few more things. In 1901, the Victor Talking Machine Company was incorporated after a merger with the Radio Corporation of America. They became the very famous company that we all have, I'm sure, many, many classical recordings from RCA Victor. So that happened October 3rd, 1901. And last one, 1954, there is a ship collision, travel ship collision. The Mastom collides with a French ship called the Tofivo and is forced to return to New York. Within a few days of this, John Cage, at age 42, and David Tudor, who is composer and pianist, will be part of a sit-down protest demanding that the ocean line company provide them with some sort of transport to Europe. And the line does give in and charters a KLM flight to transport 60, quote, hardship cases to get them to Amsterdam. And among them are Cage and composer David Tudor. And that's it. That's all I found.
Oh. Well, before we get on toward wrapping things up today, we did have a Facebook question for Stuart. And the Facebook question was from Michael Standard. He says, hello, thanks for doing this, and I hope you're doing well. How have your collaborations with composers changed over the past 20 years? And what do you think is helpful in that collaborative process from both sides, composer and performer?
Yeah, I'm not, I wonder if it's changed. What I think is the best case scenario, and this was something that I did when I was a student at Cincinnati. I studied with the percussion group Cincinnati, Al Adi, Jim Cully, and Rusty Burge. And when I was a graduate student, I think I did this twice. They were back on quarters at the time. Al would do a quarter long, Al Adi would do a quarter long writing for percussion course where the composers, I think two or three grad percussionists would be kind of guinea pigs, and the composers would write something kind of every week, and we would play it. You know, we of course talk about the instruments and things, and then they would have an assignment every week to write a few bars on something. And so we would kind of play those things and then give them feedback as to what worked, what didn't, talk about idiosyncrasies of the instruments, talk about idiomatic ways of playing it. And then at the end of the semester, you know, they had a larger project that we had to do. And that's a really, I think, the most profound thing we can do as percussionists. Like if we're able, or not even percussionists, musicians, but if we're able to work with composers, especially those who aren't percussionists, on a piece as they're developing it. So if you're collaborating with someone, rather than just say, okay, write me a piece. 6 months later, there's a piece, play it. It's great if there can be a real back and forth so that, you know, so the composer doesn't have to feel like he or she is sacrificing their vision, but this idea where, okay, let's work on stuff that can work within the confines of whatever confines you have, the idiomatic nature of the instruments, and kind of ideas going both ways. That's a perfect scenario. That doesn't really happen that often, unfortunately. But I try to do it when I can. So this last spring, we did my colleague who runs Bent Frequency with me. She's a saxophone player. We have a duo that we have a bunch of commissions for percussion and saxophone. And we worked with students at University of Georgia, which is just down the road in Athens. And so there were, I think, six students who wrote pieces for us during the semester. And we went there early in the semester and did a reading and told them, you know, gave them feedback and input, and saying I told them kind of how fast I can do octaves, you know, cleanly or whatever, you know, things like that. Because a lot of the stuff tends to be very pianistic. I don't know if you have, sometimes when they write for keyboard instruments, it's kind of from a pianistic background. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it's like, well, let's rethink that. And then we went back in April and played the pieces on the concert and recorded them. So that's a really great scenario, although we only did one reading with them. And I think it's better if you can really have a real collaboration on the creation, you know, during the process of the creation of a new work. That doesn't happen that often, though. You know, sometimes it's still good just to get pieces out there. And so if you collaborate with folks and just say, look, write a piece, I'll play it, fantastic. But if you can really have a real kind of back and forth, I think those are the most fruitful, adventures.
Well, I'm curious, what are some things that composers, or even one composer, has done while you're collaborating with them that makes the process really easy or go really smoothly or more fun?
One example. I think, it's a good question. For me, it usually happens, you know, well, I've had a couple of examples or opportunities to work with composers. Like Eric Lyon is one that comes to mind. He's at Virginia Tech, and he's writing a series of pieces, and we have one done. But he came to my studio and recorded a bunch of my instruments, and then I was writing pieces kind of based on my collection, you know. So he wrote this really great woodblock piece for woodblock and tape. That was for one of I made these woodblocks for Ray Bonds many years ago. So I have my own kind of woodblock, and it's just one of them. The problem is, though, I have to always take, you know, that instrument because it's tuned to that sound of the woodblock. So it's a cutting edge or kind of double-edged sword. But what's really great is in that process, he was sending me material. I was like, can you do what can you do on the woodblock? And I would kind of take some recordings, and he was very open to things. And I think it's really great when composers can realize that they don't know what they don't know, you know, especially with percussion. It's such a finicky thing. And if you can really have a discussion about the process, especially, okay, maybe if it's a vibraphone solo, a marimba solo, it's more straight ahead. Though there are many things we all know that these instruments are capable of that aren't maybe necessarily common knowledge. So it's good to have kind of these discussions, I think. Again, it doesn't always happen, but that's kind of what I hope for when I'm working with folks, if I can have some input into it, because after all, I'm the one who's going to play it, or other people too. But.
Right. Yeah. Well, the thing of recognizing what we don't know, that's valuable in everything. That's sure. so valuable with colleagues and people that I work with. What do you know? Just what when they ask, when you ask to find out more information.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
So this piece is for one woodblock and tape?
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, really if you great. Can make that. Well, that well, and that's I don't know. I'm impressed already because it seems like when someone doesn't know how to write for percussion, there's just 1,000 instruments. Like how you know, just well, like I don't know what to do next. I need more colors. I don't know what to do next. I need more sounds.
Yeah, that's you know. That's. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's done. Yeah.
That's a pet peeve of mine. Maybe it's because I'm getting older and the schlepping is just you know, worse yeah. and worse. But and you look at Ziklis. There's a lot of instruments. I love the piece, but it's you know a pain in the butt logistically, right? But I think there are composers sometimes that even you know I'm not going to use air quotes again, but even so-called great ones, who just threw everything in the kitchen sink, and it's like, well, I'm not sure it's compositionally interesting. It's sure cool sounds. Here's you know you set up everything and use one, you know I don't know. One crasher once or twice, you know, and then you move on. You just need all this specialized stuff.
Yeah.
I think, you know, confined, you know, limited means is really shows how the true craft of a composer a lot of times. You know, and so even Eric's piece is called Chameleon One. I think they're all going to have Chameleon in the title. It's really great piece, but the tape part is to this one woodblock. So, you know, you have to make sure you have the right pitch or whatever. But even, you know, Liza Lim, Australian composer, just wrote this piece called The Elemental Thing for Eugene Ugetti of Speak Percussion. And it's a 15-minute solo woodblock piece with no tape. So that's real.
That sounds harder to write.
Yeah. Check it out. Eugene Ugetti, I think is how you say it. He's he runs Speak Percussion in Melbourne. And it's a really fascinating piece. Yeah, I don't, you know, you get 15 minutes on one wood block is, you know, you might not be for everyone, but it's you know, it's a thing. It's interesting.
While we're talking about the wood block repertoire, I'd like to throw out one other. it's not actually a piece specifically for wood block, but Michael Dougherty's Labyrinth of Love has one movement for, maybe four wood blocks. It's originally for a singer and like chamber like solo soprano and chamber ensemble, but there's one movement that's just voice and woodblocks. And Carly and my friend Mike Van Wert got to play that with Hila, what's her last name? Eric Whitaker's wife. I can't remember. Hila Plitman or something like that. But anyway, and there's a recording of University of Michigan doing that piece on YouTube with Hila as well. It's like sometimes you get these quirky things for woodblock and it's like, well, I never expected a 15-minute long woodblock solo to be interesting, but it is somehow.
Yeah. Well, going back to Cage, you know, it's not a woodblock solo, but the third movement of Amores is for what? So seven woodblocks? Three players on seven woodblocks? Or blocks of wood, really. Little pieces. But that's a beautiful piece.
Right.
By the way, I just looked up. It's Hila Plitman. That was the singer's name. Yeah.
You beat me to it.
Well, Carly, do you want me to close out with your quiz?
Yeah.
Oh,
let's do a quiz, Casey.
we haven't done a quiz in many, many, many episodes, so I just have two questions for y'all. These are all things that come from previous topics or guests or discussions or something like that. And Stuart, we use a score. Sorry. Oh yeah, I'm still keeping score. I think we could probably throw it out. Yeah. Guess who has 1 point?
You.
Brian Nosny.
Oh gosh.
Anyway, yeah, he should. Yeah, anyway. But he's not always participating. So Stuart, we use this metronome to make it kind of feel like a game show. Okay. Do you feel like you're on a game show?
I do.
Okay.
Now, so wait, I don't remember, is the policy yell the answer out, or do we write me in the chat?
I think you have to write me in the chat, and then you have to police yourselves to get it out, because I'm not, I have to watch my other screen.
How do you even do the chat thing? I haven't used Skype in ages. Okay.
And Stuart, if you know, because you're the guest, you can yell it out. And next week, we're going to do a quiz on how to do the quiz, because apparently, because we always seem to have to review. Okay, so let's see. All right, I am an icon of electronic music, and to some, I'm considered an unsung hero of the synthesizer's development. I started the BBC Radiophonic Workshop in 1958 and later created a light synthesizing electronic machine called the Oramix machine. Who am I?
Okay, I'm not 100% certain, but I'm going to say, is it Moog?
No.
Well, that's the Moog. Yeah, the Moog synthesizer, of course, is key. This is somebody else. Carly, do you got it?
That was the only guess I had, but I wasn't right.
Oh yeah, no. This was this is a topic I presented on. I think I played some sounds and explained the.
I remember that. Like, was that the one that we had the Beatles instrument with the.
No, that's close. That's Giacinto Scelsi's instrument. That was such a cool one. I loved that discovery. That was really fun. But Daphne Oram, the composer, and I think you probably remember that name now. And of course, the trick is the Oramix machine is the big giveaway there.
Yeah.
But you might remember her.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about her way back on episode 169 on Bonnie Whiting's episode. So, okay, good.
See, technically, Casey, I think I joined at episode 171, so I don't know how fair this is.
But any true professionalist has been listening all the way up.
Every single one. No, you're right. You're right.
Can I ask a question?
And now you've given away that we brought you on board when you hadn't even been listening to the show.
So no, now this I thing listened seems... to... most
this seems extra corrupt now. Stuart, did you say you had a question?
Yeah, just a technical thing. Is that the Glamour metronome?
Oh, hey, he knows my piece. No, this one's not. This is one of the little one of these guys.
Okay. Casey, I have a question. Do you ever do you actually practice with that metronome?
I can just tell by the tone. I can tell by the tone it wasn't a serious question.
But seriously, do you?
Casey, I think
yeah,
I can't imagine walking seeing one of my students with one of these numbers going.
These things? Oh, I like these things. They're really quiet. But I mean, yeah, if you're practicing something quiet, they're cool.
All right.
Yeah. No, I'm actually using it right now with this little setup behind me because you stick this metronome under the China cymbal, and every time it ticks, the China cymbal resonates, and it makes a pretty creepy little sound. Sorry, Carly.
I was going to say, I think it's nice to have the visual of the metronome ticking while you're asking the question.
Oh, good. Yeah. Let's
do this for people watching on YouTube.
There's a lot of reasons to do it this way. This isn't just, it's not like we just made this up. So one more question. And this one I think you all will remember because it was far more recent. But this is a music history, more traditional composer question. I guess that's a hint. But this composer had a compulsive disorder called numeromania. He obsessively would count windows as he passed buildings, bricks, and even measures in his musical works, including his super, super long symphonies. He had a very particular fascination with death. And when the remains of Beethoven and Schubert were moved to Vienna's Central Cemetery in 1888, eyewitness accounts recall this composer, quote, put his fingers through the eye sockets and mouths and kiss the skulls of both composers. Who was this?
I think it's Bruckner.
You're right. It's Anton Bruckner. Yep. You nailed it. All right. Well, that's 2 points for Carly. And that concludes your quiz for the day.
Wow, 2 points.
Day. Thank you.
You're welcome. So yeah, lots of just fun trivia.
Wait, how did Carly get 2 points? Oh, because it wasn't her topic.
That's right. Yes. See, we need that quiz to review the rules again. It's been a long time. Carly, thanks for hosting today.
Hey, of course. Yeah, thanks for letting me host.
Thanks for asking. Great.
Well, I think before we wrap up, there was some sad news in the music community recently, and Ben's going to share that with us.
Yes. So on episode 80 with Brian Nosny, we talked about the composer Christopher Rouse, who Brian wrote his dissertation on Christopher Rouse's percussion works. And Christopher Rouse just passed away. He's written several works for percussion. I think most of us are very familiar with his percussion ensemble works of Ogun Badagry, Kuka Ilimoku, and Bonham. He also has a percussion concerto, whose name is in German, so I will not attempt, but it's written after one of the characters in the Wagner's The Ring cycle. And he just passed away, like I said, a few days ago. Boosey and Hawks, his publisher, wrote, Christopher Rouse built a legacy as one of America's greatest orchestral voices. His catalog of influential works is marked by extreme emotional depth and colorful orchestration and reflected his insatiable curiosity for music from across Western music history to popular rock. And I particularly love, I remember reporting on Brian's episode that Christopher Rouse saw so many percussion pieces in the 70s and 80s of just sort of like little scrapes on instruments and jingles and King of Denmark style stuff. And he said it felt like you were depriving percussionists of what like they were meant to do, which was just beat the hell out of the drums. And when you listen to his percussion music, there's definitely some hard rocking going on in it. So very sad loss for the percussion community, but we're very thankful for what he's done for our works.
I know we've asked this before, but what's y'all's favorite Christopher Rouse percussion of those pieces? I mean, I know there's the fourth lesser known and I think unpublished percussion, small percussion ensemble that Brian Nosny mentioned.
I remember Brian telling us about that. There is an unpublished one.
And I forget the title.
I will say I've never done Kuka Ilimoku, but having done Bonham, if you've got like a killer drum set in your percussion ensemble, like I had this guy that just graduated last semester named Chris Hooper, and he could play just like John Bonham. And we had him just take a John Bonham solo and open it up, and then we went into the piece. So that one's always been a favorite. Cool. Mine.
Yeah, Bonham's a solid choice. That was done by the high school students at Interlochen this summer.
Wow. Yeah. I'd probably go with Bonham too, but Kuka Ilimoku is probably a close second.
Mine's Kuka for sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bummer. So, yep, everyone reprogram your concerts now. You have to do Colgrass and Bonham.
Yeah.
Oh, and excuse me, and Rouse.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, everybody. That was great. Thank you so much, Stuart, for talking to us and sharing so much about Stockhausen and everything else. It was great to have you on.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for asking me.
And you have collaborated with so many other composers. We probably could do 5 other episodes. We just got Stockhausen out of you, but
that was the deepest one.
That was the deepest one. Okay, yeah. Well, cool. Yeah, well, thanks again.
Well, thanks for doing this podcast. It's great. And I got to listen to more so I can get some of those quizzes.
Yeah.
Get on the scoreboard.
Good luck with the future ones. This is great.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Well, thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.